I'm an addict called Vito. Hi, family. Before I start, first of all, I'd like to say some thanks out there. First of all, I'd like to thank my higher power. Without that relationship, I wouldn't be here. When I walked into Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't have a higher power, and I met one here, and it's what keeps me here. I'd also like to thank Narcotics Anonymous because of the experience, strength, and hope that I've received in the rooms kept me here. And I'd like to thank the convention committee for asking me to share here, because it's a privilege and it's an honor to share at an NA convention. Friday night when they were unveiling the banner and they were talking about the first convention in Chesapeake and Potomac, I sat and I thought a while that it actually went even farther back than that. In 85, this region hosted the 15th World Convention in Washington, D.C. at the Sherem Hotel. And the next year they were having convention withdrawal, and they hosted one area in this region, hosted the 6th East Coast Convention up at Townsend University. So this region has gone a long way back with conventions. There's a lot of service involved in here. I'm not going to give a big drug log because we've all used drugs and we've all hit a bottom. And we know what that pain is. And today we're about recovery. But I'm going to talk for a couple minutes of what it was like when I started and when I came into recovery. I started using at a very early age. About the time I started school, I came from a one-parent family. This was back in the 1940s, and there was not very many one-parent families. And my mother refused to go on welfare, so she worked three jobs. That allowed me to be on the streets 24 hours a day, practically. And I was the youngest person on the streets, and I wanted to fit in, so I became somewhat of the neighborhood clown. I was the person that would do anything to be accepted. And I started using my first drug at around 5 years old, and that was a drug, alcohol, and it made me deadly sick, but I wanted to fit in and I kept using it. By the time I was 10 years old, I was mainlining heroin. I had a $100 a day habit, and I had to live a life of crime to support it. And I never stopped using from the first day I used until 1956, when I was involved in a gun battle in a place called Orchard Beach in the Bronx, where I grew up. And I remember the police came and we threw the pieces into the bay, and I wanted to escape to get back into the main part of the Bronx, and I had to get to catch a bus at a place called City Island. So I took off through some woods, and I found myself in the summer training academy of the New York Police Department. And I had all these rookies with gray uniforms surrounding me. And I remember they took me downtown. I went to night court and was thrown in the tombs overnight. And the next morning I was brought up to Bronx County, and that was the first time I ever experienced withdrawals. I remember being in that jail cell and banging my head against the bars to create other pain in my body, because all I was doing was heaving, and that pain in my stomach and that marriage with the toilet. And the guards coming by and spitting on you, because addicts were the lowest thing on the form of earth. They didn't even consider them human beings. And I remember I detoxed in that cell. And I was in there for 30 days, and I was called before the Bronx County District Attorney, and they offered me a deal that if I would leave the state of New York, they'd put me on probation. So being an addict and always looking for that back door, I moved across the river to New Jersey. You see, I thought I no longer had a problem because I was clean for 30 days. Now I could be a good thief, because in my using, I always bungled everything up. And I figured I could use on weekends. And that lasted for about 2 weekends, and there was another 4 or 5 year blackout. And it's where I hit my bottom. I don't remember much of those years except sleeping on railroad tracks, riverbanks, under people's porches. And it came to an end one day on February 14th in 1960 in a gutter in a place called Brick Church Station in East Orange, New Jersey. My skin had turned yellow. My eyes was yellow. I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis from dirty needles. My body was loaded with lice, and I was laying in a gutter, and people were walking over me and spitting at me. And somebody had enough compassion to call an ambulance, and I was taken to a hospital. And the first thing they had done was delouse me and put me in the isolation ward because I was contagious. And being admitted under welfare, I didn't have a doctor. And they assigned this young Greek intern to me. And being an addict, I always seemed to be able to attract enablers to myself. Because he used to come in and he said, the police want to talk to you. But if you sign these papers, maybe they'll forget about you. And so one day I said, "Son, what do these papers have to do?" He said, "Well, if you sign it, there's some people like you upstairs that if you go up there, you'll be up there for a few weeks, you'll have food, it'll be nice and warm, and maybe the police will forget that you're here." And being an addict and looking for a softer and easier way, since it was the middle of the winter in the northeastern part of the United States, I signed the papers. And when I got upstairs, for those of you old enough to remember before the days of the rehabs, it was a big alcoholic ward. Just a big room with a lot of beds and people wearing hospital clothes. And I immediately got very angry because they were throwing me in with a bunch of drugs and they had a problem. I didn't have a problem. I could stop using anytime I wanted to. And I really believe that. And here they're putting me in with these sick people. And two things happened while I was in that ward that changed my life. One thing is I got friendly with an old man, and I'm going to use that cautiously because I'm older today than what he was then. But back then he looked real old. And I got friendly with this guy, and he was like most of us. You want to talk about religion? He knew it all. Talk about politics, he'll save the world. Whatever you want to talk about, he always had the answers. And I sort of drifted towards him because he was a lot like me, although back then I wouldn't say it was that way. That's how we are. We know everything. And I gravitated towards this man. The second thing that happened was a bunch of people came in once a week and brought a meeting in. And it wasn't from this fellowship. It was another fellowship. And I didn't have much respect for them because they were drunks and they had a problem and they couldn't stop drinking. See, I could stop using drugs anytime I wanted to. I just never wanted to. And I believed that lie I told myself. But when these people came in and brought the meeting, the one thing that I liked about them is they seemed to have their life put together. They had confidence. They stood up there. They had that gleam in their eye. The only thing, I didn't want to listen to them about their drinking because they had a problem, and I never had a problem. That's how great my denial was. Laying in the gutter with lice, and I didn't have a problem. Then one day this old man was being released from this facility and he went into the back room to put his street clothes on. And when he came out, he was dressed as a Skid Row bum. And I looked into the eyes of that man and for the first time in my life, I saw myself. My drug of choice was different than him, but I was no different. I was a bum too. And after he listened, after he left, I began to listen to these people when they came in and brought a meeting. And I begin to want what they had to offer because I realized that I had a problem. And when it was time for me to leave this facility, I was still homeless. I had no place to go. The only thing I had was a meeting list that they had left me. And that first night I showed up at a meeting, and what happened to me that night is what happened to me all my life. I walked into that room and they told me I didn't belong. I was different. People like me don't get better. I had a social and a moral disease. And they physically escorted me out of that meeting. But what they did do is they took this meeting list and they circled meetings that were called open meetings. And they said I could go to those meetings, but it probably wouldn't do me any good because people like me just don't get any better. Tell an addict not to come back, and what do? I started to show up at those meetings. And when I come into those meetings, I never had any problem to get a seat because I'd come in and I'd sit down and everybody would move away. It's like I had a disease. And you have to remember, in 1960s, that fellowship had all crew-cut guys with red faces and shot and beer men, and the people come in were completely different. But what was happening in the 60s, more and more people like me started to come into those rooms. And you know, they say water seeks its own level. We sort of knew that we belonged to each other. We were the same kind of people. And we used to hang out in front of the churches, and we used to really share deep, like, "Hey, what's happening, man?" I mean, that was the deepest conversation that we would have. But we stuck together. We sat together. And I was in a meeting of another fellowship in 1964 in the Vailsburg section of Newark, New Jersey, and somebody came up and tapped me on the shoulder by a nickname that I got in that fellowship. They said, "Hey, animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room." I had no idea what a drug meeting was. See, I never heard of Narcotics Anonymous. But myself and the herd of animals, we went into this back room. And for those of you who are old enough to remember the 1960s, there was a bunch of people sitting there, and the guys had these t-shirts on with peace signs on, and the girls had these long dresses and flowers in their hair. They were the hippies or the love children of that generation. And this particular group of love children were coming out of San Diego, California, and they were carrying a message they had found called Narcotics Anonymous. And when they come into a town, they check in with the other fellowship and try to get the back room. And they were crashing at these communes trying to carry a message to the hippies about you don't have to use anymore. And I call that the first day of my life because, you see, sitting in the rooms for over 4 years and not being able to open my mouth, these people allowed me to share. I heard them share, and I found out I was not unique and different, because up to that time, I thought I was insane. I had mental problems. There was nobody in the world like me, and if you found out that what was going on between my ears, you wouldn't want anything to do with me. And I found out there was other people that had the same type of thinking. And I found out the people I sat in the room with, those other animals, they began to share, and they weren't much different than me. And when these hippies moved on, we tried to get meetings together. And we had two big problems. One is we had some clean time, but we had no recovery. And believe me, there's a lot of difference between clean time and recovery. We were so sick, we'd wait for people to relapse so we could roll them. But we were clean. And the other thing that happened around New York and New Jersey, they had what they called Rockefeller laws, where two or more addicts congregated together, whether you're using or not, you could be busted. And we tried to keep meetings in secret, and we couldn't keep them going. But I kept in contact with one of these hippies who went back to San Diego. And he asked me to come out there, and I figured when I got out to San Diego, I'd find a lot of this Narcotics Anonymous. And when I got out there late in 1964, there was only two meetings in all of San Diego that was Narcotics Anonymous. One was up in Mission Hill, and the way they got that church, they told the church they were AA because nobody would rent to addicts. We were even scheming back then. And the other meeting was in the Black Panther Clubhouse, and they had no problem renting to us in East San Diego. But you see, the rest of the week, we had to go other places for our recovery. But those of us that attended the NA meeting stuck together like glue. After meetings, we'd go to the coffee shops and we'd talk about steps and we'd talk about ways of doing the steps. And I asked this man to be my sponsor. And he says, "Where are you with the steps, Vito?" I said, "Well, I'm done with them. I've heard them read now for almost every night for 5 years. That sounds familiar to some people. He says, "Well, what is your concept of the first step?" I said, "Well, I'm powerless over drugs and my life had become unmanageable." He just laughed at me and he said, "Where is the word drugs in the first step?" And he handed me this little off-colored white book, a beige book, and he says, it had steps in it, and he says, "Where's the word drugs?" And I read it and we admitted we were powerless over our addiction. I said, "Addiction, drugs, what's the difference?" And he said, "I'll tell you what the difference is. Drugs is what you put in your body. Addiction is that funny-looking thing between your ears." And I said, "What, me?" And he says, "Yes, the disease of addiction is a disease of attitudes. It's a disease of running. It's a disease of not wanting to deal with life on life's terms. Beginning and using is the final step. But the disease is alive and well before you put a chemical into your body." And he says, "You've never worked the first step." And of course, I got angry and said, "What do you mean I never worked the first step? How would you know? You weren't around me." He says, "Anybody that goes in a meeting and says they're a dope fiend, junkie, heroin addict, drug addict, and alcoholic has never worked the step, because the emphasis is on the chemicals and not on the disease." He told me I wasn't a drug addict, I was an addict. And I've identified as an addict ever since. Because what it did, it closed the back door for me. Because up to that time, I blamed all my problems on things, on the drugs I used, on my family, being born into the wrong family and everything else, if they were different, I would have been different. But the reality was that my problem was me. It was my thinking. I was born with a set of thinking that was different than normal people. I couldn't deal with reality. I wanted to run. I wanted to medicate. And the getting and using was just the final step after my addiction had kicked in. And he had told me that the first step was the things of my addiction and my past that I brought into recovery. And the next 11 steps would become my future if I chose to use them. And he explained to me I needed to go on to a second step. And I know some sponsors keep people on a first step for a long time, and you know, that's their business. There's no particular way to do the steps. What I share about the steps is just my experience with them. It's not Narcotics Anonymous' way of doing them. NA doesn't tell us how to work the steps. It's all our own personal experience, and there's 100 ways of doing it. So what I share tonight is strictly my own personal experience, and I want to clarify that right now. But my sponsor told me that we're staying on a first step is like taking your clothes off and standing in the middle of Main Street. If you stand there too long, something's going to happen. You'll be arrested for being nude in public. He said the second step is like putting on new clothes. After you surrender and admit that you're powerless, you better do something about it. And he told me that's what the second step was dressing me up in new clothes. And in my arrogance, I said to him, well, we're going to skip the second and third step. We're going to go on to the fourth step because you got to understand, I'm different. I'm an agnostic. I don't need to get into this God stuff. And he asked me a question then that really hit me because I've never had that question asked up to that time. He said, Vito, why are you an agnostic and not an atheist? And I stopped and I thought about it. I said to him, in case there's a God, I want him to know I didn't deny him. I just didn't know if it existed. And again, he said, typical addict, always with the back door. And he said to me, you don't meet God till the third step, dummy. We're going to do the second step. I said, don't run that by me. I said, I know what dope fiend manipulation is. I go to meetings. I hear people talking about a higher power and a power greater than themselves. And he looked at me and he said, a power greater than yourself could be anything that makes you aware of the insanity of doing something over and over again and expecting it to be different. It could be something somebody shares in a meeting. It could be something you read in literature. It could be something you read in a magazine. It could be anything that makes you stop and see the insanity of your action if you carry it out and do it different. And that's a power greater than yourself. And he said, someday if you come to believe in a higher power, that higher power is not going to open the skies and send angels down to fix you. That higher power is going to work through people, places, and things. So you'll always find the power greater than yourself through people, places, and things. And that made sense. And I began to become aware, and I'd look for a power greater than myself. And it helped me. And when it was time to go on to the third step, I said, there's no way that we could do that because it had the word God in it. And he asked me to read the step, and I picked it up and read the step. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And he said, what did the last part say? I said, as we understood him. He says, you don't have to have a God like anybody else's God. You could have a rock in the backyard that could be the God of your understanding if that rock is loving and caring. He said, but I don't even think you're that nutso. Why don't you just take G-O-D and turn it into good orderly direction and let that be the God of your understanding for now? Because the one nice thing about recovery is we could change our concept of God at any time while we're thinking. As we grow, our concept grows. And today I do have a God of my understanding. And thank God nobody forced a God on me when I was a newcomer because I wouldn't have stayed. I wasn't ready to have that. But I was also introduced to something then that I didn't like. I don't like it today, and people I sponsor don't like it. I was told I had to go out and get a notebook, something to write with, and buy a dictionary. And my initial cocky remark was, why do I need a dictionary? I was born in this country. I could speak English. And he said, we'll see. So I went out and I bought one of these little pocket dictionaries. And he made me go out and get one of these collegiate dictionaries. And I think I spent about $25 on it. It's probably $100 today. And it was like one of these pick and choose dictionaries. You'd open it up and there's 6, 7, 8, 9 definitions for every word. And he wanted me to look up the word decision, the word will, and the word lives, and to write about them. And I found the word decision. There was a number of definitions there, and one that seemed to fit was a starting point, a point to begin. And that made sense. And then I looked up the word lives, and that didn't exist in the dictionary. I had to go to the word life, and then I found lives in a subparagraph underneath it. But that had like 11 or 12 different definitions. One said to be alive. Another said a state of breathing. Then there was one there that said, when I was looking under lives under the subparagraph, things that occur in a lifetime. And that seemed to make some kind of sense with the step, but I still didn't see quite the connection until I looked up the word will. And under one of the definitions of the word will, at the end of the sentence, it said your reaction to things that happen in your life. And all of a sudden, the step made sense. I called my sponsor. I said, I got it figured out. I know why these people come to meetings now and say, turn it over. You go out, create your garbage, you turn it over to God, he fixes it, and you go on and make some more garbage. And he said, wrong. He said, there is nowhere in the third step that it says to turn it over. It says to turn it over to the care of. And that changes the whole meaning of what that says. And see, I was sort of brain dead back then. He said to me, Vito, if you were ever married and had a couple kids, if anybody was dumb enough to marry you, and you went out on a Saturday night, and you had a babysitter, you wouldn't turn the kids over to the babysitter to keep, you would turn them over to the care of the babysitter to watch and guide in your absence. And that's what you're to do with your will and your lives. So you don't give up your free will. You don't give up your power of choice. But what you turn it over is to a loving, caring God to guide in your life. And I looked at my sponsor and all my infinite wisdom, I said to him, when God gives me a sign, I'll work a third step. This agnostic looking for signs from God. And he just looked at me and he said, I'm going to tell you what God's will is for you today, tomorrow, and 100 years from now. To act as mature and responsible as you possibly can from where you are in your recovery. And the results will be as mature and responsible as they possibly can. And I said, huh? He said, get a job. Now this work stuff I was not about because I didn't work in my life. See, I learned that you could sign up for this thing called welfare. And the state of California would send you some checks every month, and then you take those checks and you go to the pool hall and you play 9 ball and you turn it into more money. So I looked at my sponsor and I said, but I do got a job. I play pool. He said, get a job, a real job. And at this point in my life, finally, the obsession to use was being lifted. You see, for almost the first 5 years, I jonesed on a daily basis because I didn't have a sponsor. I had a do-it-yourself program. I had a fool for a sponsor. And thank God I didn't relapse in the process. But once I got a sponsor and I started to take direction, the obsession to use was beginning to lift from me, and I did not want to go back there. So I began to take direction, and I started looking for a job, and I got a job and found out I had a talent and ability that I could make money. A lot of the same survival skills that I used in the street could be turned into legitimate use. And my life started to get better. And I used to call my sponsor up all the time and say, when are we going to put me on a fourth step? Because back then it was a big deal if you were able to do a fourth and fifth step because people weren't into the steps that much. And I wanted to be one of the elite to say that I did a fourth and fifth step. And he used to say to me, you're too sick. Stay on the first 3 steps. And this would go on for a long time when I'd call him up and say, when do you think we should put me on that fourth step? And he'd say, you're too sick. Work the first 3 steps. And finally one day he told me I could start a fourth step. 24 hours later, I called him up and said, I'm done. And he said, if I knew you wanted to go to confession, I would have told you how to get to the Catholic Church. And he explained to me that a fourth step was not a confession. It was a searching, fearless, and moral inventory. And I didn't even know what the word moral meant. And he explained to me what he wanted me to do was to go back through my life and write about my history. But he wanted me to write how I felt about that history to the best that I could recall while it was being created. And then he wanted me to write about the same thing on how I felt about it today. He said one would tell him where I was, and the second part, when I wrote how I felt about the same things today, would tell him where I had come to, so that when we did a fifth step, he knows where to tell me where to go. And it made sense. I could understand that. I couldn't understand searching, fearless, moral inventory. Those words were just too complicated. But I could understand to write about the things I did in my life and how I felt about them when I was doing them and how I felt about them today. So I got busy doing that. And when I finished it, I made an appointment to do a fifth step. And we went to a place that was between San Diego and Tijuana. It was a place called Chula Vista. And it was like rolling desert hills, sort of. And it's probably all housing developments today, the way California's grown. But we sat out on some rocks out there, and I had all these papers. And I began to read my fourth step, and he told me I couldn't read it. And I got a resentment immediately. I said, what did I go through this process of all this writing if I can't read it? And he says, you remember when you used to call me up and tell me that you couldn't do your fourth step, it was too painful, that it was bothering you, you were going to use because you were writing it? And I told you, you need to call people and talk about it because that's what's supposed to happen. He said, now that we're going to do it, that whole writing was to introduce you to you, to bring it up to the surface, to prime the well. Now you're going to look at your writings and you're going to talk about what you wrote. And I found out a lot more came out of my gut than was on paper. And when we finally finished it, I looked for this great big spiritual awakening that I heard other addicts come to meetings and share, like the city sanitation truck took it all away. And I had none of that. I had one feeling. I was glad my fourth step was done so I could go to a meeting and share that I did a fifth step. And that was my honest feeling. And I shared that with my sponsor. And he told me that if most people are honest, there's no big spiritual awakening at the end of a fifth step. It's just a gladness that it's over. The spiritual awakening comes in the weeks and the months after the fifth step, when things begin to happen in your life because the garbage is removed and your program seems to fall in place. And I begin to experience that in my life, and I see it in other people's lives today too after they finish a fifth step. And it was time to go on to the sixth step. And this agnostic said to my sponsor, is this when you get on your knees and God takes it away? See, I was beginning to believe in something outside myself. And he said, no. He said, there is nothing in the sixth step that says God removes your defects. And I said, what do you mean it doesn't say that? He says, read what it says. We become entirely ready to have God remove these things, for the process to begin. It's a preparation step. Vito became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And he told me to take a piece of paper like this, put a line right down the center of it. On one side of the line, he wanted me to identify all the defects that we talked about in the fifth step and patterns, and on the other side of the line, to put just their opposites. One would tell me where I'm at, the other would tell me where I needed to go. And it became a blueprint, a map of recovery. And he explained to me at that time there was a difference between a shortcoming and a defect. He said, even though they're rooted in the same word, a defect is part of me. It's like my disease. It's within me, like a defective car. The shortcoming is the acting out of the defect. If the shortcoming is removed from me, the defect is arrested just for today. And I thought when it was time to go on to the seventh step is that I pray to God and he takes them away. And he told me, no, you can pray to God, but that's not the whole seventh step. He said, there's two parts to it. Becoming humble. And he said one of the most humbling things for an addict to experience is to admit that they were wrong. Because a lot of us walked in these rooms and said, I may not be right all the time, but I'm never wrong. And I was one of those addicts. And you see, I had to start owning things then. I had to admit that I was wrong if I was to grow and if I was to have shortcomings removed from me. And he told me that the shortcomings are removed by God through the first three steps. They're spiritual principles. They're God-given steps. And that's why he kept me on the first three steps so long. And I had a lot of shortcomings then, and I had one that was causing me a lot of problems. I wanted to be in a relationship, and nobody wanted to be in a relationship with me. And with my wisdom, I couldn't understand why. See, I had a problem like most guys that come into recovery, whether they want to admit it or not, but I see it in the rooms year after year. I suffered from a shortcoming called violent jealousy, that my fist would go even before my mouth. And if a woman wanted to go out with me, she was a fool. Because I didn't know how to treat a woman. I knew how to disrespect a woman like a lot of addicts coming in. I knew how to hurt them and how to hit them. But I longed to have a relationship. And my sponsor told me we needed to remove that shortcoming first of all. And he said, that's why you were on the first three steps for such a period of time. And he told me that in the first step, when I begin to feel jealous, I had to get in touch with that feeling of jealousy and seeing my life become totally unmanageable, to feel it in the pit of my stomach, to feel the rage building up within me. And then I needed to go to a second step and see the insanity if I acted out on it. And then I needed to go to the third step and turn those feelings over to the care of God as I understood God, asking for help and guidance. And then go back to a second step and do it different. And I'd love to say it went away right away. But by continually working on the steps, it was lifted from me. And it has to be at least 25 years since I've had that problem. And I had to go to each one of the shortcomings that I had and begin to work the first three steps on them. And one by one, they disappeared. But the thing my sponsor didn't tell me is when we get that whole list done, that we got a whole bunch of new shortcomings we didn't know we had, and it's a lifetime process. But thank God today, the mistakes I made are not the same mistakes as when I walked in here. And when it was time to go on to the eighth step, where we made those amends, we made a list, and then we became entirely ready to make those amends. I told my sponsor, when I became willing, I would make the list. And he asked me to read the step. And I looked at the step and said, we made a list. And then we became willing. So I knew how to take directions. I made the list. And I called my sponsor and I said, the list is done, but I'm still not willing. And he says, yes, you are. Otherwise, you would have never made the list. So I know these steps were written by addicted people. Because within them, they know how we think. And being the typical addict, going from one extreme to the other, from not wanting to make any amends, that everybody owed me Christmas presents, all of a sudden I got it done, and I want to make amends to everybody. And I had to sit down with my sponsor and go over that list, because I would have injured a lot of people, including myself. And that's when it was explained to me that the step said we made direct amends to all those we had harmed, and there wasn't a period there. It said, except when to do so would injure them or others, and I was part of others, and I didn't come this far to injure myself either. And we went over that list, and I began to make the amends to those people who I knew where they were. But then there were those people who disappeared from my life, and those faceless people from alleys. And I was told they still had to be made, and made through my higher power. And if my higher power felt direct amends needed to be made, they would be placed back into my life. And I've had people show up in my life as much as 15 years later. And I knew it was time to make amends. And I also know there's no coincidences in this program, because it was in God's time. If they were in my life as a newcomer, I don't know if I could make them. But they came back at the right time. And that's why I know there's nothing as coincidences at all in recovery. And he told me the first three steps were the foundation of our recovery. The fourth through the ninth step were the cleansing steps, is where we become clean spiritually and emotionally, because we became clean physically in the first three steps. And the 10th through the 12th would be the maintenance steps. And that talked about, we did the personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I used to say to him, well, I could do that. I know how to say I'm sorry. And he says, yeah, you suffer from sorry-itis. Because addicts know how to get over with people with the words thank you and I'm sorry. And he told me not to use that word anymore, to find another way. He said, but when you're wrong, promptly admit it. What it's talking about is self-honesty. Going over my inventory and seeing when I was wrong, admit it to me so I could do something about it. Because you see, if I don't become honest and admit I was wrong to me, tomorrow when I work my program, I'm going to make that same mistake over again. And for years, I did a written inventory. I'll be honest, today I don't do a written inventory. I do a mental inventory every night before I go to sleep. But I continue to do that personal inventory because I still have shortcomings in my life. And it was time for me to go on to that 11th step, you know, where we continue to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand standing through prayer and meditation, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And we were improving it, so we should have been doing it since the third step. And thank God this program doesn't tell us how to pray or how to meditate. One of my pet peeves is when I hear somebody tell somebody how to pray. We don't have that right because we're allowed to have a God of our own understanding. People need, unless they ask for advice. Because we're a spiritual program, we're not a religious program. But one thing is certain. We need to pray and we need to meditate. And I believe very strongly in both those powers because it's my communion with the God of my understanding. I believe prayer is not asking for anything. Prayer is thanking for the blessings I've had in my life and for the blessings yet to come. And I believe meditation is not listening, but getting in contact with that power and feeling the love of my higher power. Because somebody once told me, if you don't go within, you go without. And I believe in that very strongly. In the 12th step, I did have a spiritual awakening. It said as a result of these steps, it talks about we had a spiritual awakening. And we tried to carry this message to other addicts and practice them in all of our affairs. And I believe, personally, that spiritual awakening is that the steps work. I believe they are the answer to any problem that we face in life. Yes, I realize it doesn't fix a relationship problem or a money problem or a job problem, but what it does fix is my reaction to those problems so I can work through it and I don't have to use. And I believe that's why we carry the message to other addicts that the steps are the answer and be the example by practicing them every day in our lives. And I worked those steps and my life got better. I start making money, I got the big house, I had the cars, I had everything. And I married a girl who was a non-addict. She considered herself a blue blood. Her family came over on the Mayflower. And as I progressed in that marriage, she used to say to me, why do you go to meetings with those people from that side of the tracks? You're cured. You don't need to go there anymore. You need to go to meetings like the Kiwanis or the Rotary Club. You start telling addicts stuff like that, and we get in our own heads, we're behind enemy lines. I says, yeah. And I cut back to one meeting a week, one meeting a month, show up every 6 months, and then like so many people we see, show up once a year at chip time. And what happens is we no longer pick up that phone. Our support systems crumble, and something happens internally. We go back to the old ways of stuffing feelings, of beginning to freeze on the inside. And then the ultimate happened that people in the program warned me would happen. One day the big crisis came in that marriage, and I wanted to use. I felt that Pied Piper outside my window calling me, and I no longer had the phone number. And my ego was so damn big, I couldn't call you guys up and say you were right. I was going to do it by willpower. If I only locked myself in that room and wait till the sun comes up, I was going to make it. And guess what? The sun came up and the Pied Piper was still there. And I said to myself, if I'm going to go out and use and kill myself, why not do it in one swing? I tied a rope around my neck and I jumped off the chair. And the weight of my body broke the door down, and fortunately the girl I was married cut me down. When the medics came, they said I was clinically dead, and they used those pads to revive me. And I was living in Pennsylvania at that time, and there's a law in Pennsylvania, probably in every state, that if you try to take your own life, they can mentally commit you for X amount of days. And I remember I sat down with this woman psychiatrist, and thank God she understood addiction, because after we talked for a couple hours, she says, Vito, you're a little kooky like most people, but your biggest problem is you're an addict without a program. And that if you promise to go to a meeting, I won't lock you up. And I ran to a meeting. And you see, this time I worked recovery a little bit different. At the beginning, my early years, I was a spectator and I took and took and took. I was an NA thief. I took everything there was to take. This time I meant to get involved in my program and give back, because I remember what my first sponsor would say to me. When you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you begin to rot. And you see, I had started to rot. I had thought I graduated from the 12-step academy and became ear plumas cured, and I got sick. And I got back involved in my program, and I got involved in the fellowship, and I started doing things. I started starting meetings and getting involved and giving back something that was freely given of me. And my life started to get better again, and I had to go through the pain of letting that marriage go. Because, see, that person would never understand that I needed meetings for the rest of my life. And if I stayed there, I'd either kill myself or use. And I began to take advice again. And when I was in those rooms, I met another girl. And I fell in love with her. And a lot of people here know her because we were inseparable. Every place we went, the convention, she was always with me. She was at my side. She was my best friend. You see, in Narcotics Anonymous, I've learned something in the rooms. I learned how to have a relationship. Because up to that time, I didn't know how to have a relationship. I didn't know what it was all about. And getting involved with this woman who worked the program in Narcotics Anonymous and worked steps in her life and had a sponsor and had a support group, we learned how to have a relationship. We talked about our problems. We didn't run. And then slightly over a year ago, she got sick. And she was addicted to another drug that she could never handle called nicotine. And she couldn't breathe anymore. She went in for an exploratory operation. And they found she was in stage 4 lung cancer. And they said she had 6 months to live. And the only option we had was to go to experimental chemotherapy. But we both had a God in our life, and we knew that if we did what we needed to do, that God would take care of us. And we had that faith. And we went through that first stage of chemotherapy, or she went through it. And she was about the bravest person I ever saw in my life. She never cried. She just said, God will take care of us. She went through 3 rounds of chemo, and her hair never fell out. But the sad part was, 4 weeks after she started the chemo, and we picked up the x-rays and we brought it back to the doctor's office, and he read them, and we were elated. that the tumors in her lungs were shrinking. And we knew we had this thing beat. And we went out and we ate that night. We celebrated. It was on a Thursday night. And we got home that night. And she said, I'm just feeling a little weak. I want to stay home and watch a movie. You go to the meeting, because we both had the same home group. And she gave me a big hug and a kiss and said, we're really going to beat this, V. She says, I love you very much. And I said, I love you, Patty. And I went off to the meeting. I said, I'll see you at 9:30. When I came home that night, I looked in the window as I was unlocking the door, and we had 7 toy poodles were her babies. And I seen the 7 toy poodles on the floor curled around her. She was laying in the middle of the dining room. And I ran in, and I got a cold washcloth, and I washed her face and said, Patty, come to, what's wrong? And her mouth was wide open, and her feet were up in the air, and she was breathing awful funny. And I couldn't get a response for her, so I called 911. And the ambulance came, and one of the medics asked me, did she have a head trauma? I said, I don't know. I seen her 2 hours ago. She was fine. She was in good spirits. They told me they were taking her to Mercy Hospital. I locked the dogs up and I followed in my car. And I made some phone calls from my car phone to other addicts. By the time I got to the hospital, other addicts were showing up. The emergency room doctor came out to me and said her vitals are real bad. We don't know what's wrong yet. We have to stabilize her before we can do any tests. And this was about 9:45 at night. 1 o'clock in the morning, the emergency room doctor came out and said, we got her stabilized. She's on a respiratory thing. We're gonna take her down for a CAT scan to see if we could pinpoint this. Half hour later, I was called into the family room with the neurologist. What had happened is the cancer metastasized, spread to her brain, and exploded and split her brain stem. And she was physically dead the minute it happened, didn't know what happened to her. But she was physically alive on a respirator. And they told me I had to make the decision to disconnect her and let her go. And I couldn't do that. We're talking about my best friend. We're talking about the person that I love. And I remember I went to the phone and I called Jenny, my daughter, and said, what do we do? And she said, let her go. I said, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. And this is 2 o'clock in the morning. And for the next, I don't know how many hours, to 4:30, 5 o'clock the next afternoon, I'd walk in intensive care and I'd see her there. And I'd say to her, Patty, if you have to go, go. But I can't sign the order. And I walk in and out. And finally I said, God, I need to go to a place to pray. And I went outside the hospital and I found a secluded place. And I prayed God to give me some sign of what I needed to do, because I felt like if I signed those papers, I was murdering her. And then an image flashed in my head. I remember when we were living in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, we used to go to meetings together in the same car. And when the meeting was over, I used to stop and talk to everybody along the way. And it would take me a half hour, 45 minutes to get to the car. And she always wanted to go home and watch TV. And she used to give me these funny looks like, Vito, let's get the hell out of here. Till she learned to take her own car. But when I walked in that ICU unit and I looked at the expression on her face, all of a sudden it dawned on me was that same look she used to give me after the meetings. Vito, let me go. And I knew it was time to sign those papers. I signed the papers, and less than a minute she was gone with a big smile on her face. And it was over. The addicts wanted to go home with me, and I wouldn't let them. I said I needed to be alone with the dogs. Well, at night, I cuddled in the bed with the 6 toy poodles. Morning came, the funeral home called, and I had to go pick out a casket. I had to get her clothes ready. And the addicts start calling, do you want me to help with that? And I said, no, I need to do it alone for closure. And I went and I picked out the casket. I picked out her clothes. I made the cemetery arrangements. And when that was over, the addicts start coming to the house. And we had to hold the funeral up for an extra day because our son was in Hong Kong where he lives, and he had trouble getting a plane out. And all that time, day and night, there was addicts with me. Nobody left my side. And then the funeral happened. and her home group presented the eternity medallion and put it in her casket, and they closed the casket, and we had the service in the mausoleum where she was entombed. And then everybody left, and it was over. And I hated God, and I wanted to use. I wanted to run. I could smell the dope. I could see cooking it up. I just wanted to use. I didn't want to feel. And the only thing that saved my ass is I remember what I keep telling sponsees throughout the years. Whenever you want to make a decision to use, commit to 90 and 90. And if you still want to use, then use. So I committed to doing 90 and 90 and did 254 meetings in 90 days. And thank God in Charlotte, North Carolina, we got meetings from 7 in the morning to midnight. Because I lived in meetings and didn't go to work. And when I come out the other side of that 90 and 90, I was able to take my wedding band off and put it on my keychain to remind me I had 17 wonderful years. Because some people never have it. And the reason I bring that out, because if I gave in to that obsession, I'd be gone and probably dead. Because I did what I told people to do, I'm here today. See, that miracle never stops. If we do the same things we do when we're new. We go to meetings and we talk about what's going on inside our gut. And I know that this disease never goes away because I wanted to use as bad then as when I first walked into these rooms. And then I had to get busy with life. I had to go back to work. I had to get rid of her clothes. I had to pack all that up. And when I was packing her clothes, I found a letter. And that letter said, V, if I'm dead, read this. If I'm alive, don't you dare. And that was her typical sense of humor. And she went on to tell me that the dead is dying is for the dead and living is for the living. And I had to go on. In her memory, I had to go on with my life and keep living. There was two promises that she wanted me to make. One was that I'd never go back to my ex-wife, and the second was I wouldn't get in a sick relationship. But she went on to tell me she wanted me to live, and she wanted me to get into a relationship and to go on with my life, but to always remember her. And I hadn't been on a date in 17 years. And the whole world has changed since I was in a relationship. Today it's like Russian roulette out there. They asked me to make an announcement that there's about 22 cars in the circle that are being towed away. That's the circle right outside the front doors. So I had to go through the process of getting involved in dating women. You see, back before me and Pat got together in Narcotics Anonymous, you didn't have to date nobody. You just went to bed with them. 17 years later, I find out the women in Narcotics Anonymous work programs now. They want you to date. And that wasn't easy. I knew I had to get back out and do the same thing that I did before and to be gone with my life. And I went to an NA function in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and this girl walked in, and I say, time stood still, because all of a sudden something happened to me. So I asked some people in the local fellowship up there if they would introduce me to her. You know, my higher power's got a good sense of humor, because all three people that knew her wouldn't introduce me to her. I'd say, why? They said, because. And that was the answer that I got. And I have never been a Casanova type guy. I mean, I see some of these guys walk in and they pick up women like this and so forth. So I figure I got to introduce myself somehow. Next thing you know, she's gone. So I say, shit, I got to go to every meeting in this town to find her. I didn't even know her name. They wouldn't tell me her name. After I got done speaking, I noticed she come. What I didn't know, she was speaking at another meeting and had left to leave. So I found her with her sponsee sitting at a round table like that near the wall. So the only thing I remembered back was high school days, you go stand against the wall. And I positioned myself against the wall, and I figured one of these girls got to get up and go to the bathroom, and then I'll just jump in that chair and ask her who she is. Well, I'll tell you, her sponsee's got the strongest kidneys I've ever seen. I stood there for 3 hours. Finally, the one girl gets up, and I was so worked up by this time, I jumped in that seat. I said, "I don't want to be rude. I got some questions for you. Are you married? Are you a newcomer? Or do you date?" And she got startled. And she said, "Well, I'm not married, and I'm not a newcomer, and I'll consider dating." I said, "Would you go out with me?" She said, "I told you, I will consider it." Now, I could answer yes or no, but this word, consider it. I said, "Can I have your phone number?" She says, "Yeah, do you have something to write on?" I said, "No." So I grabbed the meeting list, and she come up with a pencil. And I says, "When are you going to be home tomorrow?" She says, "Well, I should be home about 2 o'clock after church." I says, "I'll call you." And I take off with the guys. No small talk or anything. So the next day at 2 o'clock, I call, and I get an answering machine. But recovery's taught me something. You talk to answering machines. So I said who I was, and I'll call back at 3 o'clock. Well, I called back at 3 o'clock, and we were on the phone for the next 3 hours. That week, we spent over 20 hours on the phone. And today, we have a relationship. And what I'm trying to say is, because I chose to come to meetings, and I chose to stay in the program and work steps that I didn't go out and use, I have a chance at a second good relationship. And if I didn't do that 90 and 90, and I didn't commit, and I didn't do everything that I've told people to do, and listen to what you tell me to do, I would probably be dead today. But this program works today like it worked yesterday, and it will work tomorrow the way it works today if we get involved and we work it. You know, one of the problems that we have in Narcotics Anonymous, and you can see at the countdowns, where are all those people over 10 years? We have a lot of people stand up to 10 years, and then it gets less and less and less. What happened to those people? Well, we're partially to blame. See, we somehow put a class system in this fellowship. We think if somebody has 10 years or more, that they can't do something sick. They can't come to meetings and share where they're at. So they stop coming around because somebody says to them, "With the amount of time you have, you shouldn't feel that way. You're not an example to the newcomer." And that's bull. See, the only difference between an old timer and a newcomer is something called experience. The disease is equal. And I'll relate experience like a car radio. If you don't turn it on, there's no sound. If I don't use what experience I know, I'm just as sick as a person with a day clean, and I get there at times. But the difference is, I could go into my home group, and I could share where I'm at, and those people will give me experience, strength, and hope that I need to hear. They won't walk away from me. They won't say I shouldn't be that way. They'll treat me just like any other addict. And when we start treating people that way, we'll start seeing more people with time. A newcomer needs to know that even with time, there is problems. The difference is we don't have to use anymore. The newcomer needs to see people with time coming to meetings, sharing their pain so that they know the program continues to work. And we're to blame every time we hear somebody with time share, and we don't go up to them after the meeting. We let them stand there by themselves because we don't think we have anything to offer. A person with one day clean at times has saved me because they told me what I needed to hear, what I forgot because I wasn't green. We don't have a class system here. We're addicts, all of us, recovering just for today. Yes. Time means nothing. Again, I'd like to thank the convention committee for asking me to come here. It's been a privilege and an honor, and I love you all. Thank you.